Welcome back to Into the Word, our 4.5-year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. And since the broadcast date for this program is to be the 4th of July, 2024, happy birthday to the United States of America. May you bless God so that God will bless you. Let's turn our attention to Genesis chapter number 3, which we just got started on last session, kind of laid the background about the troublemaker, the serpent who is mentioned in this passage. When we go to the book of Revelation, chapter number 12, he is tied to Satan. He is tied to the devil. He is the dragon. He is the enemy of humanity. He is the troublemaking Gerub, who was in the Garden of Eden, had the name of Halel, which means brilliant one or shining one, Lucifer, if you're using the Latin, but he then turns. We don't know for sure why, other than what it does say there in the Old Testament, that there seemed to be some sort of pride issue, but he takes his first shot in this war against those that have been made in the image and likeness of God, against the couple. Now, he doesn't take them both on. He divides and conquers, which is a tactic that we see still to this day. You go after the one in hopes of compromising both or all. So Genesis 3:1 tells us, now the serpent, which we should understand to be either Satan taking on some sort of form or Satan manipulating this critter. The serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that he who is God had made. And he said to the woman, notice the woman's all by herself, did God actually say that you shall not eat of any of the tree in the garden? You can't have any of the fruit anywhere? And of course, this is another one of the tactics of temptation. You call into question whether or not God has made some sort of commandment that is unreasonable. And that's what he's hinting at here, is that God has somehow cut you off from the blessings of creation. Now, you have to give her credit. She makes it clear that no, that is not what God said. The woman said back to the serpent, and notice she's not surprised in the least that this serpent is talking to her. It's a speculation of mine and others that many of the animals that had a close connection to the human couple and would have continued to have connection with their children and grandchildren and on through the generations, that they had the natural ability to communicate, to speak. Now, modern day animals, very few of them have the ability to either vocalize in a human-like form or imitate it. But the current situation does not necessarily represent what the ancient situation was. So she doesn't appear to be concerned that this critter, this animal, is talking to her. But she says, we may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden. So no, it's the opposite of what you're saying. We can eat of any of the trees in the garden. But what God really said was, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst or the center of the garden. This is talking about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then she says, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. Now, people give her some grief in some of the commentaries, and I've heard it in sermons as well, because she says that they weren't supposed to touch it, and that that was not in the original wording that God gave to Adam. Now, the two are not mutually exclusive. It could be that God repeated the instructions once Eve was brought into existence out of Adam, and this time he added another level of it. Don't even touch it. And this is not all that surprising. I mean, most of us have either been kids or have had kids, and we have heard a parent say, don't even think about it. Don't even think about touching it. Don't even think about looking that direction whenever they're trying to help us, or we're trying to help the kid, stay out of trouble with something not so good for them. Well, I don't blame her for saying this. She either heard it or she made the conclusion based on God's language, we shouldn't even be anywhere near it. And of course, she represents properly the warning that God gave about consequences. Dying, you shall die, which our English typically goes with, you shall surely die. Verse number 4. Now Satan goes to his big power play, which is contradict God. First, you throw all sorts of questions about God's motives into the mix, or maybe your misunderstanding of his commands, or that the commands seem to be a little unreasonable or overly broad. But then ultimately, he'll get to this. No. That's not what the problem is. The serpent said to the woman, no, dying you shall not die. So he denies the consequences that God very clearly said. So, no. You're not going to die because of eating of that fruit. Then he, as I already mentioned, goes with the idea of calling God's motives into question. It's a very powerful form of building a wedge or placing a wedge between God and people. Verse 5, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened. This is a very ancient metaphor for understanding. Your eyes will be opened, and you will be like Elohim, which is the exact same word that's used for God in this whole early context of the book of Genesis. Mighty One is kind of at the base of that word, but it's a plural word. So you will be basically just like Him, knowing good and evil. Now, good, we've already seen in the story. Every time God does creative work and it turns out exactly as He'd planned, He said, it was good. It's good. It was good. It is very good once He gets to the climax. Evil, bad, is not part of the story up to this point. Other than kind of a synonym was used when God said, it's not good for the man to be alone. It would be a bad thing for him not to have a matched pair, like have a set of humanity, which God had already intended to make anyway. But in this case, we have the word evil, which is the opposite of good. So it is not the way God intended. It is not for the benefit of all involved. They don't personally know it and understand it just yet. It is a concept. But Satan throws it out there nonetheless as something to be desired, that God is keeping you from knowing everything you have a right to know. So he is pushing for her assertion of rights. Well, verse 6, this deception, this manipulation, seems to have borne fruit. Now remember, they have free will. Free will was a gift given by God to humanity at the very beginning. But free will is not genuine and it's not real unless you can choose something other than what the gifter of that free will would like you to choose. And she chooses differently than what God wanted. Verse 6, so when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and the language again here is tied into that metaphor of seeing is the same as knowing and understanding. So now she apparently goes to the tree and looks at it again, looks at it brand new with a new set of eyes, as we would say, with a different take on things thanks to Satan, thanks to the serpent. And she saw that the tree was good for food. It's got fruit on it. Well, every other tree has fruit on it, and God said all of that was good. It was very good. It was ready to go. Why would this tree be different than that? See, you can hear you can see the wheels turning. You can hear them cranking around with this because we've all been there, haven't we? Making justifications for doing something stupid. So she saw the tree was good for food. It was a delight to the eyes. You know, everything God made was pretty. Everything God made was beautiful. It touched you. And so the same is true with this tree. It looks pretty. And then finally, the thing that Satan laid in her heart as the big bomb, the thing that's going to go off, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise. Now, she already has all the knowledge that God pre-programmed into her and Adam, and that was a lot. And she has the ability to learn even more. That's a special gift that is part of being made in the image and the likeness of God, the ability to just soak up all sorts of other information and make extrapolations from that. I mean, she's been doing extrapolations right here, although for the wrong purposes and to the wrong conclusions. But in this case, she feels she wants more. Perhaps even the idea she wants instantaneous gratification. So she sees that this fruit, according to the serpent, can make you wise. And that three-part thinking process, it's got to be good to eat. It'll be tasty. It looks absolutely beautiful. It looks perfectly harmless. It doesn't look any different, really, than anything else that God has made. And that serpent has told me that really it would make me know things that God knows. And so she took its fruit and she ate. So Eve sinned. She gave in to the temptation. And this is the reason why in the New Testament, as well as some places in the Old Testament, highlight the idea that Eve was the first one to fall into sin. But she is not very far ahead of her hubby. It says that she also gave some to her husband who was with her. Now, some people get confused by that. He doesn't seem to have been there when the serpent was tempting her and conning her. It's apparently that she picks some of the fruit and eats it for herself, but brings some home for supper or lunch or whatever. And she gives it to her husband, who's now in her presence. And what does he do? It says he ate. Now, that's not a lot of detail there. The guess is, by most people, there was a conversation here that he had to be offered some of the same evidence, and I use that in air quotes, by the way, that she had received that convinced her to go ahead and go against God and eat it. And apparently, he goes along, because it says very clearly, he ate. Now, others will make a big deal out of the fact that he ate knowing the rules and knowing what the consequences were, and that he was simply going to join his wife. Now, I don't see that, folks. I do not believe that he did this just to go along with the crowd. I think he was probably convinced, just like she was, that this was the choice to be made, and that effectively God had kept back some of the informational details when he said, "Don't eat of this tree of the knowledge of good and evil." I have great respect for my wife, who likes to throw her thinking here at this point. She says that Adam's biggest sin and biggest mistake was not functioning as Eve's savior at this point. That if he had refused and then spoken to God about her choice and offered to lay down his life to redeem her, to save her, that the story would have been totally different. And I agree with that. It definitely would. But that's a lot of what might have beens. We have to talk about what really happened. And that is this. Verse number 7. Then the eyes of both were opened. Again, there's the metaphor about something clicked on the inside of their brains. And they suddenly realize something. Now, the specific thing that we are highlighted with first is this: and then they knew that they were naked. Now, you remember in the earlier creation story, we were specifically told that they were both naked and unashamed, meaning they had no coverings whatsoever. They were just their body. Just the body that God had given them. And they were with each other, and they never thought about it. But now, suddenly, it becomes a deal. Now, this seems to me to be the first example of shame in the presence of other persons. And I think I've already highlighted it in a previous comment during this series, by mentioning little children. When little children break the rules, and they get caught breaking the rules, or they make some mistake, some societal mistake in the group, and everybody notices it, what does the little child do and say? Well, they become embarrassed. And there's a physiological response to that. We have this flush that comes to our skin, and so we turn red with embarrassment. We can feel that. Our face gets hot. Our extremities get hot. That's embarrassment in a physiological form. And then the little child will sometimes say something like, "Don't look at me!" Because they feel condemned in their faux pas or their breaking of the rule, and the fact that they're being observed in this by their peers or by other people nearby. Sometimes they will try to hide. They'll cover their face with their hands because, you know, as a little kid, if you can't see someone, apparently that someone can't see you. It's a very basic misunderstanding of reality. But very common. Sometimes they'll crawl under objects. If they've got something close by that they can pull up over their head, they'll do that. That's all part of this psychosocial response to embarrassment and shame in violating the norm. Well, adults do this too. Adults will disappear. I mean, if they make a mistake, sometimes they just leave the room, go somewhere else, and they disappear. Sometimes they'll never go back there. In fact, they'll even say things like, I'll never be able to show my face there again, or I'll never be able to look them square in the eye ever again, because we're embarrassed and shamed, and we don't want to be seen. Now, what has that got to do with this, verse number 7? Well, Adam and Eve are the only people. They're the only ones in existence at this time as human beings. And so their reaction is against each other. And they are both perfect specimens of physicality. They are probably both very muscular, very trim and fit, and everything is exactly the way it should be, because the chaos, the entropy that comes with the curse has not yet hit. And so both of them are looking good in their physical bodies. And therefore, there's really only one really big distinction between the two of them. And that is their genitalia. Only their genitalia is distinct between the two of them. And so that seems to be the shame point. Don't look at me. Don't look at my difference from you. Now, they may not have understood at the very beginning the psychological reasons that they were doing this. But they were embarrassed in front of each other for having gone along with this lie from the serpent. And so their eyes were opened and they knew that they were naked, no coverings of their genitalia. And so they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. And that's all it was. Probably just only a front covering. And all it was to cover the distinction between themselves and the other person. Now, it was, as we use the terminology, only a fig leaf, meaning it didn't really do any good. But temporarily, they thought they had fixed their problem. Verse number 8. Then they heard the sound of He Who Is God walking in the cool of the day in the garden. Now, the cool of the day seems to be when the sun goes down and the temperature shift starts to take place at the termination line on the globe. And so you have a gentle breeze begin to blow from one part of that terminator to the other. And God apparently was in the habit of coming for a visit, maybe in the morning, but certainly in the evening. And he comes calling, and so the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of He Who Is God among the trees of the garden. So you can imagine, if they were ashamed in front of each other for their choice, how ashamed must they be to even anticipate being in the presence of the one who made the rule. And there's probably also anxiety over consequences. After all, God said, in the day that you eat it, dying you shall die. Well, God called to the man, said, where are you? Because they're all camouflaged and hiding out. Now, does God know where they are? Of course he does. He's God. Well, why is he asking the question? Well, why do you, after you come into a room and you know that your child or your grandchild has done something wrong, say, what did you just do? You're wanting to give them a chance to fess up. Because confession is the better choice in sin. If we confess, he is faithful and just to forgive us from our sin and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. That's the better choice for us to voluntarily own up to what we did. So that's what he does. He gives him the choice. Where are you? So Adam comes and says, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself. So far, so good, right? God said back to him, well, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree which I commanded you not to eat? Now, does God know the answer to that question? Of course he does. He's God. Why is he doing it? I repeat myself. Because voluntary confession is the best possible choice after sin. It is the one that gets you on the path to restoration fastest. But it has to be offered as a choice. And so God offers it. And the man declines it. He does one of the worst things that you can do rather than confess your own personal sin. And that is, blame somebody else. Verse number 12. The man said, the woman whom you gave to be with me, which is interesting. He's not just simply blaming the woman, he's blaming God too. You're culpable for this because you gave her to me. The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me fruit of the tree and I ate. Now, of course, she did not shove it in his mouth. She did not wrestle him down to the ground and make him eat. He chose. And that is why, when the consequences come, Adam gets consequences.